From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we examine charges of environmental racism. Activists charge that Black and Hispanic neighborhoods are ending up with a disproportionate number of toxic dumps and incinerators. We'll talk with sociologist and activist Robert Bullard, and with Robert Wolcott, who chaired the EPA's Environmental Equity Panel. Also today, Russian writer Tatiana Tolstoya tells us why she's sorry the Soviet Union has dissolved in spite of the fact she opposed the communist government. Tolstoya is from an illustrious literary family. Her grandfather was Alexei Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy was her great-granduncle. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg looks back on 50 years of new words. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has announced reductions in his country's strategic weapons and has challenged the West to join him. The BBC's Bridget Kendall reports from Moscow.
President Yeltsin's 10-point plan for Russian disarmament left no doubt that the new leadership in Moscow is anxious to slash its massive nuclear arsenal and thereby reduce its defense expenditure as fast as it can. Mr. Yeltsin warmly endorsed the arms cuts proposed by President Bush yesterday, and he hinted that his talks in Washington later this week may yield further agreements. He said new deep cuts in strategic offensive weapons were already being proposed, quoting a figure of up to 2,500 warheads on each side. But President Yeltsin also appeared anxious to demonstrate that Russia has already started to disarm, even before this year's START treaty with the United States has been ratified. He said over 1,000 nuclear warheads had already been withdrawn, and 6 nuclear submarines and 130 long-range missile launch silos were being withdrawn.
Bridget Kendall in Moscow. The president's proposed budget for fiscal 1993 would increase spending on food programs for the poor by $700 million, but critics say that's not enough. The budget would increase spending on the food stamp program by $100 million, bringing it to a record $22.7 billion. Almost 10% of Americans now use food stamps, and the program is expected to grow as the recession continues. The Women, Infants, and Children program, known as WIC, would get an additional $237 million next year. Critics said that even with the increase, the program still wouldn't serve all the women and children who are eligible. In the budget released by the White House for fiscal year 1993, President Bush has allotted nearly $3 billion more for education. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports that's a 10% increase over last year's budget.
The 1993 U.S. Department of Education budget is $32.3 billion, the largest ever proposed. The Bush administration wants more money for disadvantaged school children, special education, math and science programs, and for early childhood education. Education Secretary Lamar Alexander has earmarked about $800 million for grants for poor and middle-income families to help them choose the schools they want to send their kids to. Funds to reward schools that raise student academic achievement and money to help send teachers and administrators to education academies are also included. These are all key to the President's America 2000 education plan. The problem, experts say, is that the administration's proposed increases in the education budget this year will all but be nullified by drastic cuts in state education spending this year and the next. School board officials in over half of the states warn that $3 billion more from the federal government will not make up for the billions of dollars schools will lose because of falling property taxes. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost 47 points today to close at 3,225. This is NPR. A UN official announced plans today to help end the Somali civil war and bring relief to starving people in the East African nation. United Nations Undersecretary James Jonah said that the UN intends to start relief operations even before a ceasefire has been arranged among the warring groups. Jonah said that the relief operation might use airdrops or ships stationed offshore to get food to the Somali population. At the same time, he said that Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali is considering inviting Somali leaders to New York for ceasefire talks. The United States has stepped up pressure on Serbian leaders to accept United Nations peace plans for Yugoslavia. Jason Fear reports from Zagreb.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger today sent a message to Serbian and Yugoslavian federal leaders stating that the United States expects them to cooperate with United Nations efforts to end the 7-month-old war in Croatia. Egelberger demanded that the federal military and Serbian forces respect the territorial integrity of Croatia and other republics that were formerly part of Yugoslavia, and added that the United States rejects all attempts to alter borders on the Balkan Peninsula through the use of force. It is unclear what, if any, effect Egelberger's statements will have, as leaders of Serbian enclaves in Croatia today rejected UN proposals, despite the acceptance of the UN plans by the federal and Serbian governments. For National Public Radio, I'm Jason Fear in Zagreb.
Bethlehem Steel Corporation said today that it lost $638 million in the fourth quarter and will try to recover by slashing jobs and selling some of its operations. The Pennsylvania-based steelmaker announced a two-year restructuring plan that will cut its current workforce by almost 25%. A spokesman said it would eliminate 6,500 jobs by the end of 1993. Bethlehem's chairman said that the poor economy makes it unlikely that the company will post a profit for the first quarter of the year. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. No one wants a toxic waste dump, landfill, or incinerator located in their neighborhood. In fact, there's a school of thought in the environmental movement called NIMBY, not in my backyard. But since we continue to produce tons of hazardous waste each year, it has to go somewhere. In 1987, the Commission for Racial Justice of the United Church of Christ conducted a study and found that these toxins were being disproportionately dumped in Black, Hispanic, and Native American communities. And the head of the commission, Reverend Ben Chavis, coined the term environmental racism to describe the situation. My guest Robert Bullard wasn't surprised by the commission's findings. He had been studying the problem since 1978, when he joined the fight against a landfill plan for a Black neighborhood in Houston. Bullard, who's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Riverside, conducted a study of the siting of hazardous waste facilities throughout the southern United States. He published his findings in the book Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality. The EPA has responded to charges of environmental racism with a new report that says people of color and the poor are bearing a disproportionate environmental burden. But Bullard says the report doesn't go far enough.
I think the report is rather superficial in its analysis. It fails to examine the interplay between class and race. In all the studies that we've conducted over the last 10 years, we've found that that race and class interpenetrates in siting decisions, and it's not an either or. When we look at racism in America, we can see that people of color are impacted at all class levels when it comes to siting.
What's the most convincing evidence you can offer that race is a very significant factor in determining where toxic dumps and toxic wastes are going to be located?
Well, if you look at the EPA's own Region 4, which is basically eight states in the South, we find that there's not a shortage of poor white communities in the South. But if we try to find where the off-site commercial landfills are located in that region, right now in 1992, 100% of all of the commercial hazardous waste off-site landfills are located in zip codes that are predominantly Black. However, Blacks only make up about 20% of the population in that region. So it's not a class thing. It's not a poor poverty thing. If we look at other kinds of environmental toxins, whether it's lead, exposure to pesticides, toxic waste dumps, it's a combination of race and class.
So the problems that you're looking at include lead, toxic dumps, pollutants released into the air. Just give us a shopping list of the problems that you think Black communities and Hispanic communities are being most hard hit by environmentally.
Well, number one is lead. If we look at some other problems, we can include toxic waste incinerators, landfills, municipal landfills. We talk about chemical plants. You start naming pesticide, chemical refineries. We find all kinds of industrial facilities that happen to be located adjacent to communities of color and low-income communities, working-class communities. The emissions from the chemicals in Cancer Alley, for example, South Louisiana, that 85-mile stretch from Baton Rouge to New Orleans, it's created a nightmare, a chemical nightmare. an industrial sacrifice zone, and the people that live closest to these chemical plants are black people. And these, in many communities, were founded right after slavery, before chemical companies even thought about going there.
There's an acronym that a lot of Americans have become familiar with, NIMBY. It's an acronym for Not in My Backyard. And this was the attitude that a lot of communities took when they found out that there was going to be a dump in their area, Not in My Backyard. Do you think that the NIMBY movement has, in its own way, backfired against black communities? Because when one community said Not in My Backyard, it ended up in a black community instead?
What has happened over the years is that the NIMBY phenomena basically was a white initiated community response to all kinds of locally unwanted land uses, or LULUs as commonly referred to. And what happened is that that process of fending off noxious facilities in white communities drove these facilities toward the path of least resistance, which oftentimes meant communities of color. Oftentimes black communities did not have chapters of Sierra Club, Audubon Society, National Wildlife Federation, Greenpeace, those kinds of organizations. And in many cases, they were preoccupied with basic economics. And in the cases where there were resistance, in many cases there were resistance, the resistance actually fell on deaf ear. Blacks did not have representatives on city council, on planning commissions, on boards that actually served their interests. And so it's like not having a person on a board that comes from the community where that's impacted makes a difference.
You've said that you think that black communities are more economically and politically vulnerable to incinerators and landfills and other forms of toxic dumps. What are some of the other ways that you think black communities have been more vulnerable?
Economics. I mean, if you talk about unemployment, if you talk about land use, if you talk about political power, not having individuals on boards and commissions, you talk about institutional barriers that prevent decision-making to be equitable across the board. And it's not just a black and white thing. I mean, we're talking about environmental issues that impact people of color, from native lands to the barrios, to the poverty pockets in Appalachia, et cetera. It's a matter of organizations having the political power to resist the onslaught of proposals to put landfills and incinerators, but at the same time having the economics to say no. And the economic blackmail is involved when communities are impoverished and don't have an economic tax base and are somehow given this dangling carrot of taking this incinerator with the promise of jobs. And that's a very powerful kind of message to send, to say take these jobs or unemployment.
So what do you think about the EPA's recommendations for protection? What exactly are they recommending?
Well, I think the EPA has taken 18 months to produce a report that is less than comprehensive. And I think it's when we went to EPA and ask them to address equity and to deal with areas of disproportionate impact, particularly for low-income and communities of color, we expected something concrete to come out of it. What they have produced is basically a document that really doesn't have a lot of meat.
What are some of your recommendations for ensuring more equity in how landfills are and toxic dumps are placed around our country?
I think even before we can even get to the point of siting, we have to get to the point of asking the question, do we need all of these hazardous waste incinerators? And talk about the role of the Environmental Protection Agency in pollution prevention. I mean, if recycling is the emphasis, then we may not need as many municipal solid waste incinerators. If EPA is right now pushing incinerators, there's no incentive to recycle.
So your agenda isn't about relocating dumps. It's about cutting down on pollutants so that we don't need to have more dumps?
Exactly. We're not advocating taking all of these poisons out of communities of color and putting in white communities. We're not advocating that. There's some who see that as an option, but we're not saying that. We're saying that, and we are in total agreement with other environmentalists who say that there are some things that we have to bite the bullet on in terms of the amount of waste we create, you know, at the individual household level, as well as what we have to do with it. And so we're talking about a rational policy to deal with waste, a rational policy to deal with toxin, a rational policy to deal with all forms of environmental degradation.
Realistically, though, aren't there going to be a lot more landfills and incinerators before we really cut down on pollutants? And what do you propose that we do until we cut down on pollutants?
I think if the assumption is that we will always need landfills and incinerators, I think that what we're advocating is a rational plan of a fair share plan of equity, not targeting certain communities for these facilities, not saturating, not systematically allowing some communities to become sacrifice zones. We're talking about an equitable plan. If there's in a city where you have four quadrants, then make sure that all of the landfills are not in one quadrant. I mean, it has to be balanced. Everybody produces waste, so everyone should somehow bear the burden, bear the cost of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Bullard. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Riverside, and the author of a book called Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Bullard, author of the book Dumping in Dixie, Race, Class, and Environmental Quality. Has anybody tried to prove environmental discrimination in the courts, and has there been any success in that area?
Well, there have been, the first case that was filed in 1979, I was part of that. I collected data for a lawsuit in Houston, Texas, and my wife was a lawyer on that case, and we documented systematically that from the 20s up until 1978, the city of Houston had placed 100% of all its landfills in black communities, 6 out of 8 of the incinerators. And when the city didn't got out of the business of landfilling and turned it over to private industry, 3 out of 4 of the privately owned facilities were located in black neighborhoods. We went to federal court, and basically the judge said that the statistics were overwhelming, but we could not prove that this was willful. And so it's very difficult. A more recent case was decided in Virginia, where King and Queen County, Virginia, 4 out of 4 of the landfills from the 60s up until 1991 were located in black neighborhoods in that county. However, the judge said it was not discrimination since the Board of Supervisors balanced economic, environmental, and cultural reasons. Now, we don't know what that means, but it seems to me that having the statistics and showing overwhelming disproportionate impact is not sufficient to prove discrimination in front of these judges today.
I'm wondering if any of the communities that you've studied have had any conspiracy theories to explain why more dumps and incinerators are being located in communities of color.
Well, we don't really need any conspiracy theories. We've documented systematically that decisions that are made to locate noxious facilities are not random. As a matter of fact, there was a report that was produced for the state of California, and it was done by a consulting firm here in L.A., Sorrell Associates. And it basically gave the advice of locating waste or energy facilities, incinerators, in communities that are least likely to resist, meaning low-income, working-class communities, communities that are not likely to vote, those kinds of things. There's a report that was produced with tax money. In Dallas, Texas, for example, we documented that a lead smelter, all of the lead smelters in Dallas, by the way, located in black or Latino neighborhoods. And we documented that the city of Dallas could have closed this facility, this one facility located in West Dallas, could have closed it by enforcing a zoning ordinance. And this plant operated for 50 years, contaminating the community. It sat across the street from a 3,500-unit public housing project, next door to an elementary school, next door to a boys' club, and nothing was done. And we have records to show that basically nothing was done for the simple reason that these were just poor black kids in the projects, and that it was a low-income black community.
There is a black environmental movement that's developed. I'm referring to the environmental racism movement. Where did the movement start? Is there a time and a place that you can trace it back to?
I think if we had to pick a point, it's probably in 1982 in Warren County, North Carolina, when the state decided to place a landfill in a poor black county. And it brought national attention. It brought civil rights leaders, environmental leaders, social justice activists to converge on that community to say no. And that's when Dr. Ben Chavis from the Commission for Racial Justice coined the term environmental racism. But again, the impetus behind this equity movement springs from an extension of the civil rights movement. You know, the right to have clean air and clean water, a clean environment is considered a social justice issue. And I think it's not just a black issue.
As you've said, there were many blacks who used to see the environmental movement as a white middle class movement. Why was the environmental movement seen that way?
Because that's what it was. It was basically organizations. The organized environmental movement was basically a white middle class phenomena. And to some extent, that's the way it is today. But if we talk about increasing the numbers of people of color within those organizations as staff and as board members, but at the same time, strengthening and creating our own organizations, grassroots organizations of color, that's the fastest growing segment of the environmental movement. Small organizations that may not have environment in the name, but they deal with environmental issues, they deal with housing issues, transportation issues, health issues, all of those issues that they see as, in general terms, environmental.
Robert Bullard, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Robert Bullard is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Riverside, and author of Dumping in Dixie. We called Robert Wolcott, who chaired the EPA's Task Force on Environmental Equity. They've just completed their report analyzing race, class, and environmental risk. I asked Wolcott if the report contradicts the 1987 study by the Commission for Racial Justice of the United Church of Christ, which found race was the most prominent factor in choosing the location of commercial hazardous waste facilities.
Our study did not contradict that, but if I could expand on it for just a moment. I think it's clear that Hispanic and black communities have been the subjects of greater than average exposures to the facilities that are cited there. I think it's also very important, however, to recognize that these firms that are siting these facilities are not necessarily operating strictly from a racial targeting basis. They are trying to make, I'm sure, enlightened, efficient business decisions. And in many cases, that involves relatively low cost and in many cases, rural land, frequently around concentrations of low-income racial minorities. So I think it's very important to recognize that while there are associations between them and clearly burdens that are borne, it is not explicit targeted racism that's determining this.
You know, your study concludes that people who are black or Hispanic or people who are poor are bearing a disproportionate amount of environmental risk. I'm wondering, what's the long-term solution to have, like, wealthy people and middle-class people will have more exposure to toxics, too? Or I mean what are we looking at, finally? Like, sharing the environmental risks together or ending the risks or what?
I think that the answer to this question is rooted in education, in enlightenment, and in, if you will, bringing to the surface many decisions which are so frequently left under the surface and not available to the broad public. I think we have to understand much better the demographics of our actions and the effects of those demographics on risk. I don't believe there's any kind of swift cure for this, quite frankly. I think all we can do is make significant strides in the right direction. I think think the best way we can do this is to simply learn much more about where our most exposed populations are and how we can most rapidly and intelligently respond to this through our environmental authorities. I don't think EPA is brazen enough to purport to solve this thing in a month or a year or 5 years. It's a very complex array of risks out there that we're trying to deal with, and this is one more, I think, crucial layer that we try to bring. But EPA is already laden with extremely complex rules and regulations, and this is, as I say, just one more dimension we're going to try to bring to our task.
The activist movement has been using the word environmental racism. You use the word environmental equity. I wonder what you think of the expression environmental racism.
My concern with the expression is that it conveys intent. And I think that is an overstatement, at least in many cases. Clearly, there are perverse results that derive from actions out there that relate to siting, that relate to permitting, that relate to a whole variety of activities. But I think it's very non-productive, if you will, to focus on its being racist in intent as distinct from inequitable in result. And the latter is as compelling a reason as the former to take positive action. But I think if we simply break it down into a debate as to whether it is pure racism or whether it is merely a result of class issues, I think it just the whole issue breaks down. I think we've just got to decide that there's a major problem out there of concentrations of risk, and let's go get it instead of pointing fingers.
When it comes to the decision of where a dump or an incinerator is going to be located, what role does the EPA play?
It's really important to emphasize here that EPA as an institution plays a very, very minor role in the whole siting area that has historically been and continues to be the domain of state and local government. It is unlikely to change in that regard. There are clearly some signals that we could and might send, but that responsibility is going to vest and remain at the local level. I think the clear suggestion there is that communities have to marshal their resources and information generally to kind of show what the distributions are and what the likelihood of effects are, and to bring it down into hard fact at the local regional level. But EPA and its regional offices have very, very limited ability to affect this pattern.
Robert Wolcott chaired the EPA's Task Force on Environmental Equity. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tatiana Tolstoya is a Russian writer who is part of the illustrious Tolstoy family. She's temporarily living in the U.S., where she's watched from afar the dissolution of her country. Coming up, we talk about her country, her family, and her writing. Also, a review of 50 years worth of new words from our linguist, Jeff Nunberg. Did you know that 50 years ago we didn't have the word burp? That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush went to Capitol Hill today to sell his 1993 budget. Democrats promised to work with him on the package of proposals to stimulate the U.S. economy, but they gave much of the president's plan a cold reception. NPR's Mara Liasson reports from the Capitol.
President Bush wants Congress to pass his program by March 20th. The Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell dismissed that deadline today, pointing out that the president had taken 18 months to come up with the plan. Bush has proposed an array of tax breaks and adjustments, a $5,000 credit for first-time homebuyers, a reduction in the capital gains tax rate from 28% to 15.4%, and a $500 boost in the personal exemption for children. Democrats in Congress blasted the capital gains tax cut as yet another gift for the rich, and they said they plan to push for an even bigger tax break for families with children. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has announced cuts in his nation's nuclear arms program, and he says that U.S. cities will no longer be targets of long-range missiles. His statements came hours after President Bush proposed cuts in both U.S. and Russian nuclear stockpiles. Yeltsin's plan is aimed at stopping production of new nuclear weapons instead of doing away with existing ones. However, Yeltsin said that nuclear weapons in the world must be done away with, and he called on Britain, France, and China to take part. His cutbacks would allow Russia to focus more resources on urgent domestic needs. Officials in France say that hardline Palestinian leader George Habash has been flown to Paris after suffering a stroke. He is to undergo surgery there. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Reports say that George Habash has been flown to Paris on a hospital plane from his home in Tunis. They say he's semi-conscious and having trouble breathing. One report said he's accompanied by Red Cross workers. Press reports say he's had a brain seizure or a stroke. He had another stroke more than 10 years ago and was treated in East Germany. George Habash is the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is an extreme Marxist guerrilla group. It's striving to create a Palestinian state without making any settlements with Israel. It's accused of carrying out a number of violent terrorist attacks to achieve its aim. Its chief allies are Libya, Iraq, Algeria, and South Yemen. The group also maintains close links with North Korea. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Israeli Prime Minister Shamir and the opposition Labor Party have agreed to hold general elections June 23rd. Elections are currently set for November. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 47 points to close at 3,224.96. This is NPR News. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan says that he sees what he termed very subtle signs of improvement in the nation's economy. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Greenspan said he is concerned that efforts in Congress to cut taxes might come up with a plan that is too expensive. He said as of now, neither the president's tax proposal nor most congressional plans would overstimulate the U.S. economy. Greenspan said the Fed is seeing a stirring in the markets, including activity in the housing market. The economy shrank last year for the first time in 10 years. In 1991, gross domestic product dropped by 0.7%. This drop was largely the result of a slowdown in the fourth quarter, when growth declined to its lowest level in 1 year as the economy slipped back into recession. Daniel Jeffries reports.
We were also scared last year by the rising tide of unemployment and debt. We stayed at home and cut our spending. We even stayed home during the Christmas season, cutting back consumer spending in the last 3 months of the year by 1.1%. And home was where the problem was. The housing market slump made it difficult to pay off mortgages or release equity through home sales. But home is also where the hope is. In the last 3 months of the last year, there was a huge 10.6% jump in housing construction, marked by the lowest mortgage rates for two decades. It's housing construction which usually leads the economy out of recession. And the growth will continue, according to two of the country's largest suppliers of building materials. Both Alcan and American Standard say their order books are improving. American Standard say orders in January were nice and heavy. But the recovery will be too late for 6,500 workers at Bethlehem Steel, said to be laid off over the next 2 years as the recession continues to bite. The National Public Radio, this is Daniel Jeffries in New York.
In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Last week, our book critic John Leonard praised a new collection of short stories called Sleepwalker in a Fog by the Russian writer Tatiana Tolstoya. We invited Tolstoya to talk with us about her writing, the dissolution of her country, and about her illustrious family. Tolstoya is the great-grandniece of Leo Tolstoy and the granddaughter of Alexei Tolstoy. She's temporarily living in the United States, teaching at Goucher College. She's written several articles about the Soviet Union for The New Republic and the New York Review of Books. I asked Tolstoya how she feels about the end of the Soviet Union.
I feel very bad about it, to say the least, because what was Soviet Union? Soviet Union, for me, from my perspective, was a sort of an extended Russia, which included hundreds of nations, cultures, people living together. And you couldn't tell where Russia ends and some other people starts, because our cultures, they somehow penetrated each other, they influenced each other. Some people who are not interested in any culture, any cultural event, they felt certain hostility towards each other, they were xenophobic. But I was not. I actually enjoyed living in the middle of all these cultures that are mixed, about the way you perhaps enjoy when you live in America, in New York, especially, where you can see all colors, all nations, hear all languages. And it really, it makes your life richer, more interesting. Now, with this process of the disintegration, what is going on is that each people becomes extremely xenophobic. And people turn against their own neighbors and imagine families where parents are of different origin, they come from different cultures, so the families fell apart and children don't know what to do with their self-identity. It's a really sad process. There's nothing good in it.
You've been living in the United States recently, teaching here. Do you feel like this is a good time to be living outside of Russia, or do you wish that you were there to witness the changes?
In August, I wished I were there because there were some real changes, and there were first frightening days during the coup that lasted 3 days, 19th of August and 20th, 21st. And then after that, I guess they were the happiest days in Russia, because suddenly lots of people called me from Moscow, those who never called me before. They took the pain of dialing my number. It's very difficult to call United States just because the telephone doesn't work properly and the lines are busy. Just to laugh happily and to tell me that, look, we now live in a free country and it's such a pleasure, such a pleasure. And there was just happy laughter there on that side of the line. So I envied them unbelievably. I wanted to be there. I wanted to witness all this happiness. I want to feel that happiness. I wanted to stay there. After that, some months passed, and as far as I know, everything became again gloomy, and people didn't know what to think, what to do, and they said, well, nothing actually happened. And I worry about them all the time. So again, I have some contradictory feelings. I would like both to be there and to stay away from there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tatiana Tolstoya. She is a Russian writer with a new collection of stories called Sleepwalker in a Fog. You're from a very illustrious literary family,
And because of that, it would be hard to just blend into the background like a lot of people in the Soviet Union had tried to do, I think. I was wondering if you think that your literary heritage made it any easier or more difficult for the family in the communist Soviet Union, and if your family was on the ins or the outs with the party.
I think that it worked both ways. It was both more difficult and less difficult being representing something, being well, as my grandfather was a well-known writer. But there was an element of pure luck that he was not destroyed by Stalin, by the regime. So it's really difficult to say. He was very close to the authorities in the 30s, but the closer you come to the devil, the more dangerous it becomes. So you really don't know what is better, to stay away or to stay close. But no relative of mine has ever been a member of the party. They never messed up with this organization. It was quite possible to stay away from the party. And there is a great misunderstanding in the West that all people had to join the party if they wanted to survive, to get apartments, to make the career. It was not exactly like that. It was not exactly that way.
I'm wondering if any of the Tolstoys were studied in your classes when you were in school, and if a fuss was made about you when you were reading a Tolstoy book.
No great fuss, because somehow I always was pointed at, so to say. They always pointed their finger at me because of my family name. But there was no great fuss. There was some misunderstanding of what our family is and how we live and whatever happens inside the family. But I didn't feel that way. Perhaps there was some conversation of people behind my back, I don't know. But I never felt that way because I never thought of my literary relatives as of people, some special people. It was just a part of the family, it was a part of my world, and that was that.
When you say there were misconceptions about your family, what kind of misconceptions?
Well, for example, there was a legend that our family is unbelievably rich, and it was wrong. The thing is that Alexei Tolstoy, my grandfather, he once in late 30s or about that time was pretty well off. And he divorced his wife, my grandmother, and they became two separate families. He continued being well off, and our part of the family was not rich at all. We were closer to the poor end, though much better than other families whom I met. But there are always legends about some famous person. They believe that he lives like a king. So this idea of my grandfather being rich was transferred to our family, and there were some funny misunderstandings. For example, I remember a girl whom I barely knew in one of the grades, the highest grades in the high school. She approached me and said, just casually, you must have lots of jewels around your house. Could you bring some? I want to make buttons for my coat. That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. Our family, we have seven children. My parents have seven children. And I'm right in the middle. So I was the one who always had clothes after my elder brothers and sisters. So that's the way we lived. We were very casual in this respect. The money we had, my parents wanted to spend this money on our education because they wanted all of us speak three foreign languages. It was rather difficult, and no one speaks three languages, but most of us speak two, French and English. So all the money my father earned was spent on the education, on buying books, on going somewhere, traveling perhaps around the country. Not much, but still. And not on clothes or, God, no, I didn't know what a jewel is until I saw it in a big shop somewhere in Moscow.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Russian writer Tatiana Tolstoya, and she has a new collection of short stories called Sleepwalker in a Fog. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Russian writer Tatiana Tolstoya. Now, you graduated from college in the early 70s. I think it was around 1972. And
it was 74, actually.
74, thank you. Mm-hmm. And at that time, there were many intellectuals who were also dissidents. Many dissidents were trying to leave the Soviet Union. I'm wondering where you saw yourself fitting in at the time when you were getting out of college and trying to figure out what your next move was going to be.
There was no question of fitting in, by the way. There was no question of that, because I didn't see myself making any career. So I started working in a publishing house. It was just turned out that it's a nice job because you don't have to go to the office every day. So it gave me plenty of free time. I married at that time, and very soon I had two kids. So I was quite happy at home with my kids and with my family and with lots of friends that I happened to have just a little bit of working and a lot of reading. What was always my passion was reading.
Were you writing?
No.
When did you start to write?
In 83.
That's pretty late for a writer.
Oh, yes, it's late.
What got you going?
I don't know. I don't know, really. I think I was tired of this endless reading, and I couldn't find a text that would suit me perfectly. And at a certain moment, I just decided to write this text myself. So that's how I did that.
And you started writing stories?
Yes, short stories.
Did you get published right away in Russia?
Yes, strangely enough. My first story was published in a little magazine in Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg. And it was noted by virtually no one except some readers. We have wonderful readers. We used to have wonderful readers. Imagine, no one, no writer, no literary critic, no one absolutely noticed that story, though the magazine was very widespread. They didn't care. But the readers started writing letter after letter, saying very, very good words about my very short story, which was surprising and really nice. I really felt some support, some invisible support from invisible people. And then the second story was published again with no reaction from the literary world, but with a great reaction from readers. And only when I managed to publish one of my stories, which was in 86, in a very big and very well-known literary magazine, then suddenly the literary surrounding woke up and started searching for my other stories, which were here on the surface, but they just didn't notice them. So it was really strange.
I want to get back to something you just said. You said we used to have wonderful readers in the Soviet Union. Has reading changed?
Yes, they say yes. Because I'm interested in what is going on there in this respect, and I ask everyone who returns from Soviet Union to tell me about that. Somehow readers stopped being interested in good reading. Somehow their vision has changed. They became extremely politicized, and they are much more interested in journalism than in just literature. And if such a big literary magazine as one that is called The New World, Novy Mir, if it reached about 2 million of copies 3 years ago, now this amount fell to the bottom line of about 50,000, I guess.
since you've been living in the United States, you've been writing some journalism published in The New Republic and The New York Review of Books, yet your short stories really aren't political at all.
Yes, they are not political. Though some people think that they have some political implications, and it's possible to regard them that way, but I don't mean anything political. I'm mostly interested in lives and feelings of common people.
I was wondering if maybe you started off writing stories that weren't political because you started off publishing at a time when it still would have been difficult to get overtly political stories published.
I think that the direct political influence on a text spoils the text. The text becomes very... how should I say? No, let me say again.
Doctrinaire?
No, ephemeral. I want to say that it lives for one day. The text that has to do with politics lives for one day. Well, a week, 10 years, but it's still one day. And the text that is about, which is a piece of art, let us say, which is about some eternal feelings, it lives forever. The text that deals with politics but is written beautifully may survive millenniums, but a purely political text with no beauty will be thrown away as yesterday's newspaper. So I was never interested in politics in this respect. It's interesting to read a newspaper, but it's not interesting for me to write about it.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tatiana Tolstoya's new collection of short stories is Sleepwalker in a Fog. She'll be reading from her book this week in Philadelphia and next week in Rockville, Maryland and Washington, D.C. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. So, Linda, are you looking at last night's State of the Union address?
Last night's State of the Union, Terry, and also today's budget proposals. We're looking at the president's defense cuts and what they may mean, what Boris Yeltsin, president of the Russian Federation, has said he wants to do. And the president mentioned SDI again with a slightly different justification for Star Wars, so we're going to talk about that. But we're going to spend even more time talking about what these economic proposals the president has made may mean, what the tax changes may mean for the average voter, and we're going to talk to an average voter and see what she says.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For 50 years, the linguistics journal American Speech has been running a column called Among the New Words, about words that enter our language. These columns have now been collected in a new book called 50 Years Among the New Words. Linguist Jeff Nunberg has this review.
The New Words column first appeared in American Speech in April of 1941. I was interested to see that its first editor was Dwight Bollinger, who went on to become one of the most eminent American linguists of this century. As you might expect, a lot of the words in that column reflected the political turmoil of the times, appeasement and blitz, brass hat and fellow traveler. But clearly Americans had other things on their mind as well. The early 40s saw the first printed appearance of the words car hop, g-string, burp, and fuddy-duddy. It's odd to see burp and fuddy-duddy here. They're the kind of words I think of as always having been part of the language, and seeing them offered up as newcomers is sort of like spotting Audrey Hepburn as a cigarette girl in the last scene of the Lavender Hill Mob. It gives the columns a charm that wasn't there when they first appeared. Mostly, though, 50 Years Among the New Words is a whirlwind tour of recent American history. Lucite was new in 1939, along with soap opera, call girl, and snazzy. 1943 gave us bazooka, bobby soxer, carpool, cheesecake, radar, and swing shift. 1951, McCarthyism, disposable income, mambo, and zip gun. 1964, bossa nova and discotheque, sit-in, sex kitten, and spacewalk. 1975, Gas Guzzler, Microwave Oven, String Bikini, Pet Rock, 1986, Cocooning, Spin Doctor, Ozone Hole, Personal Organizer. Of course, most new words disappear before they can make it into the language. They're like new life forms thrown up on the beach by the sea. A few manage to grow legs and crawl up onto the land. The rest are swept away with the next tide. The 1951 word basscart never caught on as a synonym for shopping cart, nor did later words like neatnik, monokini, beefalo, or skippy, which was a short-lived 1987 acronym for school-aged kids with income and purchasing power. But here's a curious thing. You'd think that the words from the earlier columns would be more likely to have dropped out by now. But in fact, it's almost the opposite. Of the 33 words that Dwight Bollinger recorded in that first column in 1941, only a half dozen or so are no longer in use. But after that, the attrition rate keeps increasing, and it's actually highest for the words in the last columns in the book, which recorded words from the late 80s. When did you last hear dweeb or boy toy? What are the odds for continued survival of the expressions 30-something, molly, or fusion in a jar? Of course, it could be that the editors of American Speech simply don't have their ears to the right patches of ground anymore. But I suspect that aside from technological terms, the infant mortality rate for new words really is getting higher. This may be partly because of the accelerating pace of events and the attenuated American attention span. The mambo was around for a decade. The lambada was here and gone in a weekend. Then, too, except for Walter Winchell, the press didn't used to invent its own words. Whereas now you can't pick up a newspaper or turn on the TV without running into a journalistic creation like confrontainment or shock jock or execu-crime. I think of these as pet rock words. They're useless novelties that nobody expects to be picked up for a second season. Incidentally, the phrase pet rock word is itself a good example of a pet rock word, and if any contributors to the New Words column of American Speech happen to be listening, I hope they'll give this one a miss.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. He reviewed 50 years among the new words published by the Cambridge University Press. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landerl, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Supreme Court has agreed to rule on the constitutionality of the restrictive Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act. This will test where the Supreme Court stands on abortion. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Catherine Colbert, the lawyer who will challenge the Pennsylvania restrictions before the Supreme Court. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.